I need the script. I've said this 60 times, this little piece of script. I still have to read it.
You should have it tattooed on your wrist.
Yeah, need to be that. Okay. Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome, everybody, to Season 3, Episode 8. There's some boogieing. There's some boogieing happening.
I reckon, Dad, I reckon your voice is getting deeper by the week.
maybe it's all the yelling that I've been doing as people were passing me on the red carpet.
Simon,
turn around. Yeah, let me take your photograph.
I signed that bit of paper. What more do you want?
Simon, at the beginning of every show, he's like making faces and throwing shapes. It's so hard not to laugh.
You got to get it. You got to get a groove on, don't you?
All right. Just in case you're joining us for the first time, I should introduce myself. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio shape throwing
Simon.
And Kaylee Carruthers. I don't know what I do.
You did a little wormy thing, isn't it?
In today's episode, some lucky people have seen double the number of frames of The Hobbit, whereas some of us haven't seen any. And we're also going to be talking about Andrea Arnold taking on Emily Bronte with Wuthering Heights. But first, what is in the mailbag?
Dun, dun, dun. Let me just get it on the phone.
I've got one more.
I'm ready.
Good.
Good fan and friend of the show, Rudy, sent us his Skyfall review, so I'll just read a snippet of it. Sam Mendes nailed the movie. What a guy. I'm a huge fan, except for Jarhead, but I think he's a great director. I agree with Dan. I thought Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, and Skyfall were linked, but the last one feels a bit out of context. I watched Casino Royale and Quantum the night before I watched Skyfall and couldn't link them very well. I have to say Quantum of Solace isn't too bad right after you watch Casino, and it's definitely it's better when you watch it for the second time. You guys should do a special episode of James Bond and invite me.
Okay, well,
maybe we'll do a James Bond holiday special.
Maybe we should. I was watching the Top Gear, Bond car special, which was very entertaining last night. I also have a Skyfall review from listener Max in London, who says, Skyfall is a propaganda movie, really. MI6 must be protected from public scrutiny, etc., because assorted Arabs, foreigners, etc., are only too keen to blow up Lord's cricket ground during the tea break. Earlier Bonds had some humour, indicative of the whole absurdity of the thesis. Ah, the Brits. Instead of having to deal with foreigners on equal terms, how we yearn to sit on a cool veranda in the evening in some country where we got the natives hooked on drugs and be served a cold drink. So, Max, my Marxist friend in London.
I like it, Max. Keep them coming. That's awesome.
Indeed. And any two words coming from people?
On Twitter, actually, we got some spam this week.
Excellent. That means we've made it.
Yeah, from Leslie H. 8393946. Wow, Cinematica cast, what a show today. Can't believe it's free.
Brilliant.
Brilliant.
Can't believe it is free. It's and tell all your friends.
I know, can I?
Sakura 59, who today is celebrating her 1-year anniversary of moving to Australia. You guys and girls made me really want to see Compliance. No release date here, though. So her and Robert Caddo, who's also
moving to Australia,
they are going to be hanging out in Australia waiting to see Compliance because they like us so much.
That's a sign. It's just a sign of how advanced New Zealand cinema culture is, isn't it, really?
It really is.
Although they've got Holy Motors and we don't have Holy Motors, so maybe it's not quite as simple as all that.
And Miriam Ruth Ross, her two-word review of Beasts of the Southern Wild, savagely beautiful.
Oh, nice work, nice work. So just a quick rundown of what New Zealanders have been watching at the movies. Has anything dramatic happened to the New Zealand top five?
Actually, yeah, there's a little bit of drama this week. Down to 5 from 4 is Argo. Down to 4 from 3 is Untouchables. Opening at number 3 is Talash, which I'm assuming is a Bollywood film.
Yeah, I'd say that would be, yep.
Poof, there you go. Sitting at number 2 is Twilight, and still 2 weeks, number 1 is Skyfall.
Right, that's all good. And is Skyfall held on in terms of its percentage, or is it dropping away after a couple of weeks? Lots of people going to see it twice, I reckon.
Yeah, drop-off is 30%.
That's good. That's very good. I think you'll see it still over Christmas.
Yep, I'd say so. And there's a massive crush for screens coming up over Christmas and New Year. And the main pressure on screens coming up from next week, we're about to talk about. So time to head in the direction of Middle-earth.
I like visitors as much as the next Hobbit. But I do like to know them before they come visiting.
Mr. Baggins?
At your service.
I'm surrounded by dwarves. What are they doing here?
Oh, they're quite a merry gathering.
So, this is the Hobbit.
You asked me to find the 14th member of this company, and I have chosen Mr. Baggins.
Me? No, 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 no.
Hobbits can pass unseen by most if they choose, which gives us a distinct advantage.
We will seize this chance to take back Erebor!
Here, Mr. Bilbo, where are you off to?
I'm going on an adventure!
And joining us on our adventure to talk about The Hobbit is special guest from Auckland, Sarah Watt from the Sunday Star Times. Sarah, welcome back to the show. It seems like you've hardly been away.
Yes, feels like that to me as well.
Have you recovered?
I've got little photos of you all just sitting around my desk here, so I feel like we're all together.
That's good, because you want to sort of bring the whole thing to life. Talking of bringing the whole thing to life, you saw The Hobbit last week, and you saw it in this newfangled 48 frames per second. Like, what do they call it? High frame rate.
High frame rate.
HFR. High frame rate. HFR, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah.
did it seem more lifelike?
It completely blew my mind, to be honest with you. And I realized that in saying this, I might come across as a bit of a Luddite. I'm not a video gamer. I don't have a 3D television. I know that there is technology out there that I don't exploit. But nonetheless, this was still far and away the most amazing thing that I have, the most extraordinary thing that I've ever seen. And
whoa.
I say extraordinary rather than amazing, because amazing kind of implies that I really, really liked what I saw. But really what I'm trying to express is I've never seen anything like it, and I was kind of dumbstruck for quite some time.
And so you, this is a tricky one, because you're not actually saying that it's any good.
Well, no. Do I have time? Qualify what I was trying to say. I found at first so different to anything that I'd seen before that it was slightly discomforting. It's hyper realistic. It felt at points like the actors were performing their roles directly when I say directly in front of me, I don't mean holographically, you know, I don't mean like a Obi-Wan Kenobi sort of Star Wars experience, but I just mean so hyper real that it was quite distracting. And my only beef with that is that for something like The Hobbit, which is a fantasy world with goblins and orcs and dwarves and fundamentally unreal characters, I need to get immersed in that world. And I found that a little bit tricky, because I was so distracted by the extraordinary technology side of things.
So how would you compare that to Rings, Lord of the Rings trilogy? How would you, in the sense that the immersiveness of it, you know, which is, it's darker, isn't it?
And it's
I don't know, there's things hidden, and it's kind of, I mean, it's
I
a darker
much
film.
I got caught up in the Lord of the Rings films, and I think you're right, Simon, the darkness had a lot to do with that. It was more absorbing, wasn't it?
Yeah, plot-wise.
I mean, it's certainly a lot more sinister than The Hobbit, which is a lot lighter.
Yes.
But it's just interesting visually to look at it, the differences between the two. You know, I think that's quite an interesting point.
My question about something being sort of hyper-real and much more realistic than we're used to on the big screen is, like, how real do you want something to be when it's 40 feet high? You know, it's like it's already a kind of unreal thing when you're looking at somebody's face, for example, a close up on the size of the embassy screen. Do you really want to get that close?
Well, the thing is, when you see it and it does these amazing panning shots, it is spectacular. Like it is quite, you know, it's amazing to look at. So from that point of view, it's very effective. I think what struck me is when you get the close-up scenes between characters or little fight action scenes and stuff like that, and how they kind of translate in 48 frames. I'm like you. I found it a little bit hard to get used to at the start, but then you know, it didn't really become, it wasn't an issue after maybe, I don't know, you know, a few minutes of the film. There were some funny times, I thought, when, you know, he was running through the Shire and stuff, where it just seemed a little bit odd. But on the whole, I was pretty impressed with it.
Let's talk about the film itself now, because I think that,
because, you know, everyone will see it in 48 frames, right?
No, that's right.
It's actually quite difficult to see it in 48 frames in some parts of the country. Like, you've really got to make a bit of an effort, I think, and a bit of a pilgrimage maybe to some locations. But the film itself, there's been a lot of talk about how it was a relatively short book compared to The Lord of the Rings. It's going to be three longish films. Do the bones of the story so far sustain that that kind of epic scale?
Personally, I think it was okay in that regard. I mean, I do think that 2 hours 40 was a little bit long for any movie other than Michael Mann's Heat, which could quite frankly have been 6 hours and I would have been happy. But apart from Heat, I do think, 2 hours 40, and because it's a quest film as well, a quest story, so it's basically episodes of a fight here, a battle there, an escape here, and so on. It gets a little bit fatiguing. But I don't feel that it was padded out, and I don't think... I didn't feel that it particularly dragged or that there was gratuitous content in it. What did you think, Simon?
I found the first 20 or 30 minutes of it a little bit heavy going. I just felt that it took quite a bit of time to get going. But once it got going, I was more than happy. I thought, it's a way and it's really interesting. And it is, there's a lot more kind of interaction with the characters. I found the whole sort of laying the foundation with Frodo, the whole setting of this, telling the story and showing Frodo there for quite, he's in there for quite a lot of the film at the start.
Oh, you mean Bilbo?
No.
Is there a bit of a framing sort of device, a backstory?
Oh, yeah, there's a backstory going on and all that sort of thing. I mean, I found that that was...
I did wonder why he was here.
Yeah, that certainly takes its time to get going. And even the scene in the actual, house, where the dwarfs arrive and they're all arriving, one after the other, and that takes a wee while to get going. But
lot of characters to introduce.
It is a lot of characters.
How many dwarfs are there?
Yeah.
But at least that has a bit of humour to it. It has a bit of slapstick and it's almost, to me, it's funny. It almost felt like a kid's film for half of it.
Yes.
And then it gets quite sort of, my youngest son who's 7, I probably wouldn't want him to watch the second half, but he could quite happily sit through the first. It's really interesting how it's kind of, that's worked out.
There was a scene in it, this isn't too much of a spoiler, particularly obviously for those who know the story, but the scene where the dwarves are captured by the trolls, for me, I just thought, this has all just got a bit childish and a bit boring, a bit silly, and the humour, I thought, was very basic and ho-ho-ho kind of, and not particularly sophisticated, and those are the sorts of scenes I could have done without and could have had a lot more. I could have had Gollum and Bilbo in the cave the first time that they meet, doing the riddle off. I could have had a whole movie of that, quite frankly, and it would have been extraordinary. That for me was superlative acting, incredible CGI on Gollum. I just thought Andy Serkis was amazing, and that I found very engaging compared with, as you say, the more childlike humor aspects of particularly the trolls around the campfire.
Yeah, and once Gollum's on the scene, the whole thing lifts, doesn't it? It lifts massively, hugely. It's really interesting, and I mean Martin Freeman is a great Bilbo. Like, he's really good in the role, and it's like you really want him to, I could take, the more he was on screen, the better for me. But particularly when he gets in there with Gollum, that is a really, really heavy part of the film, isn't it? A really smart part of the film.
All right. Are you counting down until next Christmas, when the middle film in this trilogy, are you sort of, did it leave you hanging there wanting more?
It delivered what I thought it would. I was never a big Rings fan, and I'm not. I sat through this, and I thought, technically, it's just spot on. It's incredibly well made, and it's true to form in terms of how the other films have been made. I think for people who are real fans of The Hobbit and The Rings, they'll get what they need out of it. I think it delivers for them. So I think it ticks most of the boxes that it needs to. So I think, but am I hanging out for next Christmas? I'll look forward to watching it, the second one, but I'm not going to be counting down the days.
Sarah, how do you feel about it? Did it leave you on tenterhooks?
No, well, it's such a good question, Dan, because interestingly, narratively, I'm not that bothered. I'm really not that invested in whether they get to Erebor and fight the dragon or not, to be perfectly honest with you. But technologically, I am looking forward to next Christmas to see, A, whether my eye has tuned in sufficiently over the intervening 12 months that it's less strange to me and more just awesome, in which case hopefully I can lose myself in it and, you know, have a good time. And also, I guess it'll be interesting to see whether James Cameron leaps on that bandwagon so quickly that we actually see other works of art, if you will, in that 48 frames per second over the next 12 months, so that by next Christmas it is very much more de rigueur, if
yeah,
you will.
I think that's a very interesting question. I know that Cameron wants to make his the next Avatar films in high frame rate, but they're not going to be around for a while. They're not even scheduled to start shooting. There is the Andy Serkis production of Animal Farm, which is being shot in the UK at the moment, which is performance capture, being directed by Andy Serkis, who's the expert at it, as for all that experience in Gollum, and that's being shot in the high frame rate. So, but I don't know if that's actually due out in next year. So, it's not like when 3D. I remember when Beowulf came out was the first sort of digital live action. Semi-live action 3D movie, and they were and there was a buzz, and then there were quite a few sort of quite quickly on its heels to sort of ride that wave. So Avatar didn't lead that charge. There'd already been quite a few beforehand, and I remember watching Beowulf and being really underwhelmed by the film, as most people were, but thinking to myself, well, you know, The Jazz Singer wasn't much of a film either, and look what changed
that
brought.
That spawned.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe high frame rate will do the same thing.
Do you know, I'll be interested to see what you think when it comes out later on. Life of Pi as a 3D film for adults, which I guess, you know, The Hobbit is essentially a family / adult film. Be interesting to see how people will look at Life of Pi and how the 3D works for them.
All right. I'm going to put both of you on the spot now because we have to sum up The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, and with our two words, 2 hours and 40 out of however many it's going to be. All of the topic, the fate of an entire nation's economy rests on the success of this film. Yeah. Two words, ladies and gentlemen. One of you.
I knew this was coming and I didn't think of it. Damn.
Well, look, for me, because I was really impressed with him, and I thought, you know, like he really gives the film a lot of sort of soul, or, you know, like interest. I thought Martin Freeman did a really good job. So for me, it is Freeman magic.
All right. Good stuff. And Sarah, have you got anything to add to that?
I haven't got anything clever. The two adjectives that strike me is that it's groundbreaking and extraordinary.
Right.
Yep, very true.
And my coworker, her two words for The Hobbit was short humor.
Yes. Yep.
Good stuff. Nice.
Can I make a quick point, maybe for a brief discussion, regarding the use of the 48 frames and so on? You know how you mentioned about 3D and how it came in, and then quite swiftly other films jumped on the bandwagon and started using it. And now, of course, we have films that are in 3D for absolutely no real reason whatsoever, other than they had the technology and they thought it might be fun for a spear to come out of the screen into our face. I would be interested in how judicious filmmakers are in their choices of whether to use 48 or the high frame rate or not. Do you know whether they would use it in a gritty sort of domestic drama context when it might actually be quite compelling to have people close up and personal, or whether it will be reserved for horror films or fantasy epics or whatever?
It's a very interesting question, because I think people originally thought 3D was only going to be for either animation or for big blockbusters, and then what happened? Werner Herzog turned up and made an absolutely brilliant documentary.
A cave documentary, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think this is one of those situations where we really have to trust that artists need to get their hands on the technology.
But it's about immersion, isn't it? Like, I don't think The Hobbit really has any amazing sort of features, or certainly not one after the other. It doesn't bombard you with kind of, you know, gimmicky sort of things coming out of the screen, but it does immerse you. It tries to immerse you in that world, and that's, I think, you know, it's funny, like the only stuff that I've really seen nowadays which is kind of more traditional 3D of things leaping out of screens and so on, it's with the animation. You know, and even then it's quite sparing. It's not I always thought with 3D that we'd be bombarded with that sort of special effects side of it, And we're not. It's really interesting. I thought we'd get a lot more of it than we do.
On the subject of 3D, in next week's show, we'll be playing an extract from the interview that Miriam Ross and I did with Michael Lewis, who's the founder and CEO of Real-D, who was here last week for the Hobbit premiere. And we had a very long and interesting chat with him about the past, present and future of the technology. And so the long version of that interview will be a cinematic extra for those film technology geeks who like to get into the, sort of all the bells and whistles of it all. But there will be an extract from that interview with him in the show next week, so we'll find out a little bit more about what's happening in the world of 3D. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us on the show once again. And enjoy the rest of your evening, and it's time for us to go to the news.
Thank you, Dan. In exciting Cinematica news, this week, or last week, we sent in some questions to Beasts of the Southern Wild director Ben Zeitlin.
Yeah.
And he has answered them. Yay!
Yeah.
Wow.
Answered our cool, isn't it? Answered our questions.
Yeah, so we are going to put those in the news section on our website, which is cinematica.co.nz, and in the show notes I'll put a link so you can just click on it. It'll take you over to the news, and you could read the
Does he just smack me on the head and say, you just don't get it?
No, it's actually, there's some really nice questions, and he's, you know, very, very writerly.
Yeah, thoughtful answers. Thoughtful answers.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Not although, cut and pasted from other interviews, I don't think.
Oh, yes. Although we should have asked him how to pronounce his lead actress's name.
Oh, we should have, yes. But yeah, we actually sent those, we sent those questions off a couple of weeks ago, and it's taken a wee while to filter through the system. So the question about the pronunciation, which we had in last week's show, sadly we weren't able to ask that. But but never mind. You'll get a chance to read the interview on the website.
Yes. And friend of Cinematica, Tusi Tamasese, and his film The Orator dominated the first annual Sorta Annual NZ Film Awards on Tuesday night.
At the MOAs.
Yes, the MOAs, in a glittering ceremony at the Civic Winter Garden in Auckland. The Orator picked up the key awards for Best Film, Best Director, Best Script, Best Actor for their lead actor, whose name I cannot pronounce.
Oh, come on, I gave you loads of really good names in this news.
I don't want to try because I would offend. Okay. Best actor, best actress, and best supporting actress.
So and there will be a link in the show notes so that you can find out a list of all the winners, because they gave away a lot of gongs last night, and it's apparently it was a fantastic ceremony streamed live via the New Zealand Herald website, so people could see it, and I hope that this is a new tradition.
Yeah, it's very good, isn't it?
Congratulations to Hugh Sunday and Ant Timpson for organising it.
Yes, we should go next year.
We should
have an award. We should have our own award.
Bonza. Get on there.
Okay. The New York Film Critics Circle really got the Oscar season underway on Monday with their annual awards. The big winner was Kathryn Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty, which won Best Picture and Best Director. Surprise prize went to Rachel Weisz for her performance in Terrence Davies' The Deep Blue Sea, and P.T. Anderson's The Master received nothing, but it did win the Sight and Sound Critics Poll for Best Film, which was published last week.
Interesting thing about the New York Film Critics Circle Awards is that they don't just get together to hand out the awards, they get together to actually discuss having the award, so they sit in a room and they argue, and it took 5 hours to announce these, and so it was like the naming
Pope,
yeah, a new Pope, exactly.
New
Pope. Every so often there would be a new puff of smoke.
Yeah, that's right.
And people online waiting for these awards complaining bitterly that they've got places to be.
I reckon they knew what they were going to do. They just had a cup of tea and put up their feet, watched a few movies.
But there's some interesting articles from people who were in the room in the discussions, because evidently it's not all sort of secret negotiations, secret discussions. People have come back out and they've said, well, this is what the discussion was like. This is what it was about. Very interesting sort of behind the curtain look. So, fascinating. And I think there's some pointers there for the future.
And the film's awards season has just fully kicked off. It's on fire. The European Film Awards had their ceremony on the beautiful island of Malta on Sunday night, and Michael Haneke's Amour swept the major categories: best film, best director, best actor for Jean-Louis
Trintignant.
You sure? Yep.
Maybe.
And best actress for Emmanuel Riva.
Yeah. And my favourite tweet of the week, I think, came from a member of the press who was at the party, the after party for that, who described watching Michael Haneke in the bar afterwards. He said he couldn't hear what he was saying, but he'd love to have known, because he was actually making jazz hands. gestures, and I'm just trying to imagine the dour old Michael Haneke really sort of setting a bar alight after.
Is he dour?
No, probably not. I don't imagine he is, but you'd think so from the film.
Oh, because a schoolmate of mine has a photo with him, and he was like smiling away. He looked really nice.
All right, there we go.
Apparently, she had dinner with him. I don't.
I'm sure he just gets it all out on screen, doesn't he? Gets all of that angst out on screen.
Maybe.
Okay.
Will you forget me?
I could no more forget you than myself.
Close your eyes. Open your mouth.
You've treated me so badly, Kathy. But I came and I was
nothing. You broke my heart.
Whoa, Wuthering Heights, Andrea Arnold's new adaptation of Emily Bronte. And joining us on the line from Auckland is the New Zealand listeners, David Larson, who's going to help us out with the second part of the program. G'day, David. Can you hear us?
Hey, guys, I can hear you very well.
Brilliant. Lovely to have you on the show once again. Now, Wuthering Heights is a story that has been told on screen how many times now? It seems to be a perennial on big screen and small, and in fact, from my childhood, 7-inch vinyl record. So
the classic version that none of us can forget.
Exactly. So I'm just wondering what you think Andrea Arnold's production brings to the story. What's new?
What's new is that it feels new. She's stripped so much of the incrustations of this is how we tell literary stories on film away and gone right back to the bare bones of the book and reinterpreted it as a film, which doesn't sound like it ought to be a radical thing to do. But when you look at the adaptations that we've had in the past, so many of them use a lot of voiceover, use these really clunky narrative devices and make it look really, really pretty, because that's how we make films about English history. We make it look pretty. My God, this is not a pretty film. This is a rugged film, and it's a very, very quiet film. There's not a lot of talking in it. A lot of the storytelling is done visually. It's a very, very bleak film. You're out on the moor. You're out on the heath, and it's not a heath. It's a moor. Is it a moor or a heath?
Oh, it's a heathy moor or a moory heath.
It's not Moorcliff. It's Heathcliff on the moor. So sorry. Vanishing down the rabbit hole.
Look, I saw this on Friday night at the end of a very, very long day for me, and it was after, not only that, it was also after watching Skyfall for the second time, so it was an interesting double feature. And
you saw those in the wrong order?
Yeah, probably, but, you know, you take what you can get, don't you, really? And yes. So I must admit that it was... I admired it. I admired the bravery of the storytelling. I admired the bravery of stripping it down to its emotional core. But it was maddening at times. Did you not feel?
Maddening in what sense?
In a sense of...
It's a maddening story.
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of it, maddening handheld wobbly camera, which was, I found, quite disconcerting over quite long sequences of running around the moors following Heathcliff and Kathy. Yeah, yeah.
And staying very close to them as well.
Yeah.
And I am not necessarily a fan of the handheld camera, but I really, really liked the cinematography in this film. I thought it was great. I found it really just, I'm going to use the I word, I found it really immersive. Mm. I really felt that it put me there with them. And I didn't get that slightly queasy pit of the stomach feeling from it at all, actually. And I guess I saw it back at the film festival, I should say, at this point. So I'm drawing on memories from a while ago now. But I think it was the third film that I saw in a day of five films, and it's one of the ones that has really stayed with me strongly. You have to work. It's a film almost entirely lacking in music, isn't it? So there's no music, there's hardly any dialogue, an awful lot of the time. I mean, that clip that you played was, I mean, what else can you play on a podcast? But it was misrepresentative in that it was nearly all speech, and there's these long stretches of silence where you're just having to follow with your eyes and figure out what the hell is happening.
It is. It's a wonderful evocation of internal internal emotion and the stuff that's actually tearing Heathcliff apart. Like, I got him. I absolutely got him for probably the first time, really, in terms of his alienation and his bitterness. And I appreciated that. What dialogue there is actually dropped me out of the story periodically, because it was kind of clunky and not terribly well... the line readings were just, it just felt a little bit like, oh, we really don't want any dialogue in here, but we have to have something that tells you what happens next, or what tells you what's gone on behind the scenes. And it just, it was like almost begrudging what dialogue there was.
Oh, I liked it. I had occasional niggles with the acting in the second half in particular. How far deeply are we getting into spoiler territory here, given that this is a book that's been around for 1.5 centuries?
I think we're on fairly safe ground, to be honest.
So Heathcliff goes away at the midpoint of the story. He goes away as a teenager, he comes back as a man, and so you've got two pairs of actors playing the two leads as children and as adults. And I didn't find the adults quite as satisfying as I did the children, but I really, really liked the children. I liked the rough, rugged way they acted. Have you noticed that Andrea Arnold really seems to like to cast unknowns?
Yeah, I have noticed that. And Fish Tank, which was her previous film, which was didn't get a release in New Zealand apart from through the World Cinema Showcase, and yet, you know, has been anointed by the Criterion Collection already. You know, so like it's very highly regarded. The lead actor in that, she found sort of standing on a railway station platform.
Yes, I've heard that story.
Yeah, so and she does have a magnificent eye for faces. While I appreciate what you're saying about the younger versions of the characters being more appealing, the grown-up Kathy is so gorgeous.
She is gorgeous, and that's
Brazilian, apparently.
Kathy's become this very refined lady by that point in the story, but I just didn't think she had enough subtlety to carry it off. Or enough passion, really. I mean, Kathy is such a strong character, and now she's living this very indoors, refined life, and she's been running all over the heath as a girl.
That's right. She wimps out a little bit, doesn't she?
She wimps out, yeah. And Kathy should not be a wimp. She should never be a wimp. That's a word you should just never associate with her.
Right.
I should stress that this is just a really, really unpleasant story. I mean, Emily Bronte wrote a really nasty book. That's one of the things I love about it. There are practically no people in it that you can even vaguely like. And the ones in the book that you can vaguely like aren't really in the film. So so it's not something to go in, and it's not Jane Eyre. It's not a story that you can anchor yourself in by really identifying with a particular character and rooting for her and hoping that everything goes well. What's fascinating about these people is that they're completely selfish. They're really quite unpleasant, but they have
they're strikingly modern in that sense, aren't they?
in their
self-absorption and their desire to follow their own path regardless of whatever society might choose for them. You know, it's quite a modern story in that respect. Is there anybody else around the table that's seen this? Kaylee, hand up. Yes, hand up in the corner. You young lady.
Yes. I was looking forward to this. I did miss it at the film festival. I was kind of on the fence whether I wanted to see it or not. So I was really looking forward to it and excited when it got a general release. And I really wanted to like it, but I didn't. I thought it was really aesthetically pleasing. Like, it was absolutely beautiful to watch, but it made me feel nauseous. I haven't read the book. So I know the basics of the story, but I had a hard time following it. And
interesting.
Yeah, and it just made me a bit antsy, and it was just a bit too long and a bit too kind of almost, I know it's too strong a word, but esoteric is what kind of comes to mind. It's like I didn't.
It's an art house film, definitely.
It is hard. I found the only.
It's very uncompromising, isn't it?
Yeah, and the only thing I could really compare it to is like, you know, like European slow cinema. Like, it just has that kind of like slow ticking over. And I do enjoy.
Look, I really can't argue with you. I can absolutely see that it's not going to work for everybody. But did you admire it?
I did admire it. I thought it was a beautiful telling of a story. And like I said, I really wanted, even when I was watching it, I was like, I really want to like this, but it's just not keeping my attention.
Something we haven't mentioned is the bravery. Oh, is it brave or is it just, again, strikingly modern? The the racial, I guess, undertones of the book made made real in the film, in that Heathcliff
for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. He isn't just a gypsy or just a dark skinned sort of local from
Tom Hardy,
a Romany somebody, or Tom Hardy.
Have you read the book, Dan?
No, I haven't.
I don't think you're quite right there. When you go through the book and read it closely, it's very unclear what Heathcliff looks like, and I think that's quite deliberate. He's described in quite different terms in different places. He's actually quite hard to place, and you get the impression that he is hard to place, that you look at him and you don't quite know what his racial background is, and here he's clearly black. Now,
yeah.
I think it works. I think it works really well in the film, and it brings really interesting things to the story. The notion that maybe he's an escaped slave, or at any rate he's seen as an escaped slave, absolutely plays into – he's so angry, he's so full of pride, he's treated – terribly by all sorts of people, and you can absolutely see that
there are comments made about how he might have been a prince back in Africa, and that sense of being dispossessed.
A prince in India, which is
you're right. Yeah,
is he an Indian? Is he an African? He's described as a gypsy at one point. He's called a Lascar, which is this mixed race caste of people who used to sail the trading ships in the 19th century. So. There's enough room there for Andrea Arnold to say, look, that the book gives me a bit of cover, and I definitely think it works. But she's stretching a point, really.
or making one. And so I think that we've sort of reached the conclusion that this is not for everybody, but in terms of the growth of Andrea Arnold's career as a very, very exciting filmmaker, I think it's if you've been following Red Road and Fish Tank and now this one, I do think it's definitely worth seeking out. It's not playing in very many places, is it?
It's at one place that I know of in Auckland. It's in Christchurch. You guys have got it, so I'm not sure if it's anywhere beyond that.
Right, when you say you guys, you mean the cinema that we are loosely associated with.
Forgive me. Yes, I didn't mean to collapse you. Yeah.
That's all right. But
I think of you, I think of that cinema because you've got that lovely studio upstairs.
Indeed. Look, absolutely.
Leaking today. It's been raining. It's raining so hard. The walls have been leaking.
Leaky studio upstairs.
That's right.
Maybe that's why it's so clean today. So, look, we're going to put you on the spot here, David, and ask you for just to try and reduce Wuthering Heights, the movie, down to two words. Is that possible?
Oh, Lord, I'd forgotten you did this.
Yeah, that's a bit of a critical, you know, a literary kind of a big ask.
It is a big ask. I'll tell you, I'll start with my two. My two are maddeningly esoteric.
Oh.
How about this? Visual power.
Visual power, good.
Yeah, good.
I have two, actually. I have two-word reviews.
Oh, forward.
Yes.
Oh, that's cheating.
My first one.
I want two more words.
My first two-word review is aesthetic/esoteric, and my other two-word review is beautiful boar.
Oh,
Kaylee, you're so glad you're in Wellington, and
I'm sorry. I do have a copy.
We'll have words, young lady.
Yeah.
I do have a copy of the book. I have a digital e-copy because it is one of those Gutenberg Project books where it's free to download if you have an e-reader. So I will read it, and then I'll go back and rewatch.
Can I read you an early review of the book, which I found online today?
Yes, please.
It's very short. How a human being could have attempted such a book as The Present without committing suicide before he had finished a dozen chapters is a mystery. It is a compound of vulgar depravity and unnatural horrors. So you have fun with that.
Well, that's a recipe for good times there and then, isn't it? Brilliant stuff. Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights. And now it's time for a little change of pace. So you're staying with us, David, because this is another one that you've seen.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
When you have to look. Are you drunk?
No, I'm not drunk.
What's wrong with you?
Yes, Kat, I know I did flute, but yes, can take tell you mean dad has gift us.
Well, my son's getting married in Italy. I'm Philip.
Ida.
Michael, you can't be both worthless and unambitious.
I really don't understand why anybody will work for you when you're so awful.
I pay him good money.
Here we go. That is another film by a female filmmaker with definitely, what would you say, a history, you know, an Academy Award winning female director as well. The film is called Love Is All You Need, and I don't have my notes in front of me, so David, you're going to tell me, remind me the name of the, Suzanne Bier, isn't it?
Suzanne Bier.
I knew it would come to me just at the moment or I'd give up. Suzanne Bier, and she's working with a former Bond in Pierce Brosnan on this particular film. So this is a film that I haven't yet seen, so I'm going to yield the floor to whoever wants to tell us about this one. Kaylee shaking her head. Simon, this is one you've seen.
I have seen this, yeah.
Great. Yep. What's it about, mate?
It's just a nice kind of family clash type film where Pierce Brosnan plays this. Actually, I think he trades like fruit and things like that, and he's this, you know, big trader, and his wife has passed on, and his son is getting married, and it's just about him heading off off to the Greek islands, I think, from memory, and
not singing ABBA songs this time.
No singing, and he meets this woman also along the way who is actually going to see her daughter get married as well, and she's kind of in a marriage that is on the wane. And it's just about how these two, throughout the course of this wedding and how they meet, how they sort of connect. So it's a lovely, warm, kind of slow-moving, has-its-moments kind of film. I mean, it's probably not a bad fit for what's around over the time of year that they're releasing it, because it's all, you know, it's just a nice, light,
sort of soft art house. That sort of easy palatable.
It's quite palatable, quite digestible.
You should mention that she may be dying of cancer.
Oh, yes, there is that drama to it, isn't there? Sorry,
is that a spoiler?
That's true, and she's suffering from cancer, and no, she's recovering, isn't she?
She right at the start, she thinks she's in remission, but it's not entirely clear, and there's a few worrying symptoms, and she's a hairdresser, isn't she? And she's lost all her hair, so we find out a little way into the film she's actually wearing a wig.
She wears these mighty wigs, doesn't she? And in fact, she walks in on her husband having his way with a young nubile thing, and she's still forgiving. She's still sort of, you know, they kind of have a bit of a dust-up, but she's still kind of this type of character that always is looking for the best in people and always trying to find goodness and all that sort of thing. And I think that's, you know, and that's the sort of thing that attracts Pierce Brosnan to her.
Yeah. So what... Sorry, David, carry on.
No, you go.
I was just going to say, I'm just looking at Suzanne Bier's previous history, and her films including After the Wedding, Brothers, In a Better World, these are challenging, heavyweight, emotional dramas. And when I saw the trailer for this film, I wondered whether she'd sort of sold out, really. Would that be fair comment, or does it still have that core?
I don't think it's a sellout. I think she's just trying something different, and it is, you know, like, there are definitely moments. I mean, it still has a European feel to it to me. Like, it still has this the way that the relationships work.
We should mention that it's about three quarters in Danish.
Yeah, it is. It's in Danish. It's subtitled.
It's multilingual.
Yeah. But there is actually, you know, there's some interesting things that happen between the characters and the son who's getting married. He's going through this kind of trying to recover from the death of his mother, and I guess, I mean, there are some spoilers to do with him, so I wouldn't go into too much detail, but, you know, it does have its moments where it's quite nicely crafted. I mean, it's just that it's not, it's just not in the same heavy hitting category as those other films.
Right.
It's very consciously light, isn't it? But it's not trying to, how shall we say, all the ugliness of life is in there. It's just that there are people choosing to be as optimistic and lighthearted and lovely about it as they can.
Yeah.
So it's kind of it's a comedy, but it's not a.
Oh, was it? Is it a comedy?
It's not a wish fulfillment comedy, shall we say?
Well, I'll tell you what. You've actually just done a really good job of selling me on that, because I like films where people are trying to do the right thing and trying to be nice to each other and trying to work their problems out, rather than films that are about people being beastly to each other.
Well, you find yourself willing them to get together, don't you? Like, you kind of, like, she's so nice and he's had this, you know, suffering
in his
past.
He's kind of very unpleasant, actually, but you find out early on that he lost his wife and he's never really got over it, and he's a wounded soul.
Oh, right. Needs a bit of healing.
You kind of are sitting there thinking, well, she's going to heal him, but is she? And is it all going to work out? And incidentally, do you guys know what's her name? Trina Dearholm. Have you seen her in other things?
No. No, not me. Unless without sort of without actually remembering it. Let me just see. I have IMDb in front of myself. So Trina Dearholm. What have we got here? She was in A Better World. She was in A Better World with Suzanne Beer. She was in something called Sunshine Barry and the Disco Worms, apparently, which is a Danish animated epic, I would imagine. So,
if anybody out there has seen that, please tweet us your review.
Absolutely. Two words, please. Sunshine Barry and the Disco Worms. Brilliant. So,
in any case, she's really nice. I really like her. She's very plausible as this very simple, very lovely, very, very kind of quietly strong woman.
Yeah, and you could find her very frustrating, couldn't you? Like, you could find a character like that, sort of, you almost want to give them a slap and say, you know, you've got to shake it, you know, sort yourself out and get on with it. But I didn't find myself wanting to do that with her, which, you know, often with those types of characters I do. But I found her, you know, quite believable. I enjoyed watching her, more so in some ways than Brosnan. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, he's an odd one, isn't he? I can't really see past James Bond.
He doesn't really stretch out, does he, Brosnan?
Well, he appears in a Danish language movie, but he doesn't speak a lot of Danish. Did you get the sense that he actually spoke the language at all, by the way, Simon?
I couldn't say. I didn't get that impression, no. I don't think he did.
It's like he was just standing there on set and they'd point to him every so often. Yeah, but
he did have a kind of a mean streak to him, which I hadn't, you know, necessarily seen before. But it was a funny combination of this kind of business, you know, shark. And then as the film wore on, he kind of actually, these things came through where he, you know, he had a code and he actually... was, you know, did have good, you know, good intentions towards people, but he was just a bit rough on the outside. Mm. You know, so I liked it.
So Love Is All You Need, sneak previewing this weekend, I think, around The Joint. It's not actually full, or is it opening this week?
It opens on the 13th of December. Right. I don't think it's sneaking because I could be in a bit of trouble if it is.
Okay, so opening on the 13th. On my calendar I've got, I had it down for some sneaks, but I haven't been keeping mine up to date, I have to say. David, do you know any more than we do about that?
I should. Give me a moment. Just talk among yourselves.
Sure. Simon can be thinking of his two-word review, can't he?
Is All You Need. Yeah, I've got it opening tomorrow.
Oh, okay. So there we go. A little bit of a.
Not tomorrow. Tomorrow week.
Thank you. I'm just getting off the floor.
sorry, Simon.
Now you want me to do two words. I can think of them, but they're not very nice. Yeah. Holy crap. Yeah.
Okay, so Love Is All You Need, Suzanne Beer, opening next week in across New Zealand at your favourite local arthouse location. Two words. Who's going to come up with their two words first?
Ooh. Okay, how about this? Make lemonade.
How about, it's Danish, right, isn't it? Danish Delight.
Oh, good stuff. Danish Delight from Simon. That is Love Is All You Need. And David Larson, thanks very much for joining us on the show. And you're about to head off to a screening of which we're all extremely envious. So I hope you enjoy it. And I look forward to reading your review of the film you're about to see tonight when it comes out. When's is this going to be for your like Christmas edition of the listener?
Oh, golly, no. We'll review it when it comes out, which isn't... Am I allowed to tell people what I'm about to see?
I have no idea.
Yeah, all right, I suppose so. It's just going to make me feel bad.
I'm off to see Zero Dark Thirty, which is the Catherine Bigelow film about the night they got Osama.
Yeah, not just the night, though, isn't it? It's like sort of like the hunt for Osama, and it's all very... Apparently, it's extremely accurate.
Don't tell me. My God, I've spent months maintaining my ignorance of this film. Don't blow it in the last
But it has a homeland feel, doesn't it? Oh, well, breaking them down.
Yeah,
in any case, it opens at the end of January.
Spoiler alert. he dies at the end.
Damn you!
Yeah.
Oh, apparently the ending's very controversial.
Right. I'm very much looking forward to it. The Hurt Locker was a wonderful piece of visceral filmmaking. Mm.
Can I just say, do you think, like, if you look at what's coming out of the US, you look at what she made with The Hurt Locker and now this, I mean, they're right at the front, aren't they, in terms of sort of political type films that are coming out of there. She's, you know, they don't come thick and fast, but, well, not since Clooney's kind of stopped making them. But
no, that's right. I think Clooney would like to make more, but has to sort of go off and make money beforehand. But yeah, I think that Catherine Bigelow's making some very, very interesting choices now. Mm. And I very much look forward to reading your review of it when it comes out. Maybe we'll get you on the show to talk about it again, David.
That'd be great. It's going to be an interesting one for sure.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Good night.
Thanks a lot, guys.
And that's our show for this week. Next week on the show, Donald Trump gets the special treatment in You've Been Trumped. And we'll also be talking about I Am Anna and that interview that we promised you with Michael Lewis from Real D. So that'll be on the show next week. All that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget, click subscribe and you'll get the episodes arriving automatically every Thursday morning. Please leave us feedback at the iTunes store. Or wherever you get your podcasts, or send your feedback direct to us via various carrier pigeon, postcard, or electronic means.
It's like ghost dog. Send the pigeons. You can find us on Twitter. Speaking of birds, you can find us on Twitter at CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast. And as well on our website at www.cinematica.co.nz.
And this show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was Earl Van Dyke's 6x6, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music. Here's Neil Finn and the closing credit music from The Hobbit. It's called Song of the Lonely Mountain. Until next week, that's all from me.
Good night.
And all from me. And now I know who Neil Finn is. Thank you, Dan. All eyes on the hidden